Hello once again, and welcome to another episode of the podcast. Happy Sunday, everyone. And for those of you not freezing your tail feathers off, seriously, this cold weather is nuts. I hope all of you are able to stay safe and warm, and I'm sure that all of us are dreaming of warmer days. I'll even take 30 degrees at this point. With that being said, welcome back to the podcast. This week is episode 152 and my interview with Jillian Gonda. Jillian is just the superb human being who I met a few weeks before I left Santa Fe. And she's been doing some really cool work that kind of intersects with this podcast, inner spirituality, religious versus spiritual, and just how people connect with the divine today in whatever way. But we can get to all that later. A little bit about Jillian. Jillian has worked with organizations interested in creating a more whole and loving world through spiritual awareness, strong program design, deep engagement, reflective practice, and storytelling. She is a lover of stories, and her story this week is really beautiful and profound, and I'm so very grateful that she chose to share it with me. The work she's recently been doing with the Fetzer Institute is very exciting, and there will be a link to the study that we talk about in the episode show notes as well as on the treasures page of the website. I was eagerly awaiting the results of the study, especially post-COVID. I think we all, during that time, experienced depression and loneliness or the loss of a loved one or the loss of a rite of passage. And so I was really anticipating the results of this study to see how such a cultural moment would shake or shift people's foundations as far as connection with the divine. I urge you all to click on the link and check it out. It's actually quite fascinating. But enough about that. I want you to meet Jillian, who is, again, very cool. So let's begin. Here's episode 152 of Bite-Sized Blessings.
My husband died in a hospice center. We had a five-year-old at the time, and he was really clear that he, you know, didn't want to die at home, but he wanted to die in a comfortable place. And so we found a beautiful hospice center, Rose Arbor Hospice, which was in Kalamazoo, Michigan. As he was getting closer and the nurses were explaining, you know, what signs we were looking for his, you know, passing, he was very, you know, much less lucid, sleeping, you know, pretty much all the time. And my biggest fear staying overnight with him was that I was going to be asleep when he died.
Are you? How would you introduce yourself?
Yeah, thank you. Well, Kirsten, it's just been these few conversations we've had to get to know each other in Santa Fe were just delightful for me. And that's such a good question about, you know, how we describe ourselves. And I've had such an interesting, you know, to me, as I reflect back on how my vocational life has informed who I am, and then who I am is informed my vocational life. And I think back about how does that tell a story of like who I actually am, right? And so I would say that I am kind of an individual on this inner life pursuit that is also really enamored by helping others tell their story or, you know, have their vision. So my career began in public broadcasting, which was all about, you know, people telling their stories and how it helped change society for better. And I think that's I started working when I was 18 at the public television station and was involved with a production within weeks of starting that had to do with bringing the stories of pro-choice and pro-life people together. And so it was this hugely explosive you know, potentially explosive topic. And the way the documentarian, you know, told that story was really getting into people's inner lives of who they really are and how they make their choices. And that was so instructive for me. And it turned into this, you know, beautiful, beautiful production that when it was shared, it was shared with an intentional pro-life and pro-choice audience. So they could see in the real time, these stories coming from these different perspectives. And it was just really transformative. And I think back to that as being like a key moment for me of like, what's the kind of work that I want to do in the world? And so I think I would describe myself as like someone who really wants to see how our inner lives can help create outer change. And for myself and for others, nurturing that, supporting that, bringing, you know, awareness to how that can work has been, you know, how what kind of, you know, person I am and with others, with a purpose in mind. And other than that, I would describe myself as a now single mother. I'm a widow. I'm a mother of three and, you know, just someone who's fiercely interested in, you know, wanting to make the world a better place and who we are and how we're in touch with that being, you know, the main ingredient of that. And I would finally say, because it's a really important part of who I am, that I am a New Mexican through and through. I would describe myself as a New Mexican and proud to be one. And I can say more about how that's been, you know, part of my journey as well. But that's how I would describe myself.
I really love that. I do think, honestly, you might be the first guest. You know, I interviewed obviously a lot of people because I lived in Santa Fe. I interviewed a lot of people who grew up in New Mexico or really feel like it's their home. But you were the first person to say that, yeah. You were New Mexican through and through. I love that.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I have a tattoo of the Sandia Mountains on my arm. I have really owned that as I came back to New Mexico. So I think it's part of that for some New Mexicans. And I know that there's other places they talk about this boomerang effect. You know, you're born somewhere that's kind of in you and then you go away and then it calls you back. And I left New Mexico in my early 30s to move to Atlanta, Georgia. After that, I was in Kalamazoo, Michigan for about 15 years. And I mentioned I was a widow. Losing my husband in Michigan was, you know, probably the biggest moment of my life of where, you know, I had to kind of resort some things and the recognition of New Mexico being my heart home, not only my native land, but just really where I am most myself. And that call to come home really became loud a few years ago. And there's a Spanish word, I don't know if you know it, cadencia, which is kind of a multifaceted Spanish word, but it means a combination of a love of place, a love of home, a love of land, a love of people. That is something that's very alive for a lot of cultures in New Mexico. And what I recognize is that it became something really living in me that I needed to live out my cadencia back in New Mexico. And that coming home, I have really felt that. And I feel so lucky to be a New Mexican. Honestly, you know, it's a great state. It offers a lot.
There is some truth to the notion that it's the land of entrapment.
No entrapment.
And yes, enchantment.
Right. Well, of course, it's the land of enchantment. But what that enchantment does is it really holds people here, right? And those that go are like, I got to come back because it's the notion of what you're doing in these conversations, too. And I think about bite-sized blessings and I think about blessings in general. Having a spiritual connection to one's home and one's place and being aware of that connection. That's, you know, when I talked about who I am and kind of what I hope to bring to the world. I mean, I added that last part. It is that you know, awareness, when we're aware of how we feel inside, what we're connected to, and we bring that out to our outer world, that awareness is so critical. And I don't know that enough people recognize it in actually where they live and their surroundings and how that impacts them or affects them. So I really feel blessed to be in New Mexico, and I feel doubly blessed that I'm aware of what this state offers.
Love to hear your story around if you grew up in a religious household, what did that look like?
Sure.
And how you've grown out of that or emerged out of it and what it looks like now.
Yeah, I love this question because it's I think it just is such a way to kind of understand how people are wired and how they who became who they are. And I would say I have a pretty fascinating, to me, like maybe not to others, you know, just evolution of my spiritual or religious life. So I mentioned, you know, I'm from here. I was born here in New Mexico. And as I didn't come from a historically New Mexican family, my parents, they met in Paris in the 60s, kind of wonderful story, you know, of kind of meet in the Beat Generation in Paris. My dad was in the army, but my mom was working, I think also for the government. I think she was working for the State Department and was in Paris, but they really had no interest in that kind of life. But because of what was happening in the 60s in Paris, and you know, they were free spirits. And as soon as my dad was out of the army, they were ready to come back to the States, but they had already had my brother there, and then got married in Paris, and then they moved to Colorado, where my grandfather lived, and tried to figure out what was next for them. I just heard my mom tell the story the other day about how they just knew they wanted to come down to New Mexico, and they headed south. And somehow they decided to take a left turn. And once they were getting close to Albuquerque, to find this small little village of Placidas, which is between Albuquerque and Santa Fe. And they fell in love with it immediately. Eventually found a house to buy that was on 2 acres, like for $10,000 back in, you know, 1968. I'm telling all this background just because love of place was really part of their life, and it really instilled in me in an early age about appreciation of where we lived. My spiritual background is decidedly not religious, but has, you know, tinges of spiritual teachings from my parents. My parents were both, you know, and they were very explicit with my brother and I. They felt they were forced to go to church when they were young, and they had no interest in bringing any of that to how they were going to raise their kids. So they felt that, you know, it would be better to instill us in some philosophy lessons. So I had a lot of, you know, like Alan Watts and just other, you know, Eastern philosophy, Eastern sort of religion, you know, but it wasn't described that way to us. It was really more of kind of a Taoist perspective of, you know, we just go with the flow. Everything is kind of connected, and place and recognizing that from a philosophical vantage point, but also a geographical vantage point. I remember early on some of the more, you know, spiritual lessons maybe I got particularly from my father were hiking to the North Peak, which is the northernmost peak of the Sandia Mountains, and just taking in this incredible landscape, right? And just, you know, whether it was this literal from my dad, what I recall is him really giving me the sense of how we're all connected to this natural world, and that we're all, you know, and just appreciating that and being aware of it was what was important. So I didn't grow up with any religion. And as I got married and had kids, I actually started to lament that because I felt like I had no cultural knowledge. I grew up with friends that were Catholic or Presbyterian or even Mormon, and I loved to go to church with them because it was just like like I just felt like there was this whole world that I had no awareness of that I got to like tip in a toe into and just experience. Maybe I was more interested in the Sunday school treats, but I did, you know, have a sense that there's just a world that I had no, you know, part of, and I didn't know anything about. And so when I had kids, when I met my husband, he was a Catholic atheist. I say it as such because that's a particular kind of atheist, I think, is when you're very, very Catholic. And he was an altar boy and the whole thing, and just kind of like, you know, when he was a teenager, said, no, not for me. I'm not buying it. And but I loved that I had this access, as his parents are very devout and continue to be to this day, you know, going to Mass and learning a lot more. And he, because he grew up in the church, you know, knew everything, knew the Stations of the Cross, knew Peter from Paul, and knew all the, you know, who was who, knew the players. And then knew the rituals and what they were, you know, intended to do. And so I really appreciated that. But when our kids were little, I just recognized how much I needed to bring to them because of what I didn't have. And I started taking them to a Unitarian church, which was really a wonderful step for us. We became Unitarian, and they have an incredible religious education program that goes through more than just, you know, one tradition, from Christianity to Judaism to Buddhism and beyond. Really helps kids kind of understand all the traditions that are out there. And I think I really have the same perspective that the Unitarian Church has, is that there are many paths to one idea, and, you know, you can find what works for you. And that I, you know, has been a principle that stayed with me since then.
What a beautiful, I just love that. I mean, okay, I've also never heard of a Catholic atheist. I think that's fascinating and kind of fabulous. And I think also goes to just the freedom that we have these days, yes, for more nuance in our lives, yes, especially around belief or religion or connection to something outside of us. And
yes,
you know, I've interviewed a lot of people on this show, and lots of different belief sets, lots of different religions, atheists, agnostics, you name it. And there's no judgment. You know, this is supposed to be kind of like, I don't know if you'd say it's an interfaith show or something like that, an interfaith show potentially. But I do think it's kind of a really fun and exciting time to be alive, because, yeah. You know, we don't have to be Catholic. We, you know, if you're a religious, you don't have to hide. You're not, you know, in most parts of the world, you don't have to be afraid of being killed for your religion. There's just more freedom around it, which I think is really beautiful. Thank goodness.
Well, and I think, if I may, that is a particular entree point to some work that I have been involved with recently. One of my last employer was this incredible foundation that's based in Kalamazoo, Michigan, the Fetzer Institute. Fetzer Institute's been around for many decades, founded by John Fetzer, who was a spiritual seeker himself, kind of born at the turn of the century. And his resources really came from his media holdings that he had in the 40s. And then he went on to own the Detroit Tigers. He's in Michigan. But all the while had a deep spiritual yearning and he was a spiritual searcher. He had, and funny enough, talking about the pandemic, he had almost died in the influenza in the teens, in the 1900s. And at that moment kind of had a moment, an epiphany and a blessing for his life to say, you know, I want to give back, because I'm still here. And so after his very illustrious business career, he sold everything and put it into the Fetzer Institute, and so that they could continue to, you know, have this search for how the spiritual life helps us and the inner life helps us, and this So yeah, it's a wonderful foundation, and their mission is to help build a spiritual foundation for a loving world. So as part of my work with them, I had the privilege of supporting a few studies that we did around spirituality. So they did a study in 2020 looking at, you know, cross section of Americans, 3,600 Americans, very good research that was able to be nationally representative of how people think and talk about spirituality. And recently it was refielded with an angle of COVID, because when the first study was released, it was in 2020, we had already started the pandemic, but the data was already had already been gathered before the pandemic, just before the pandemic. So it was quote unquote clean data, like it had yet been influenced by how the pandemic might have affected the answers to these questions, which were really about what does spirituality mean to you and how would you describe it and how do you live it? But they refielded it here in 2022 toward the end of the pandemic, asking the same questions and with a few more pointed ones about how did your spiritual life change as a result of the pandemic. So some fascinating results I can share a little bit more about. But to your point of just the nuance and the time that we're in right now, the nuance of people's religious and spiritual lives, that really came through in these studies. One of their novel methodologies on this was asking people to draw what spirituality meant to them before they took the survey. We did that with the second one. In the first study, it was in focus groups, having people draw what spirituality meant to them, and then ensuing in a conversation with their focus group participants. And they were fascinating. I mean, such an interesting way to start that conversation. And the nuance you describe was we saw it in so many of these focus groups and rich conversations and, you know, and showing the, you know, maybe the ways we have stereotypes of people and what their religious or spiritual lives are. I recall in the first study, there was a participant, Daniel, who was in a focus group, and he was with a group of spiritual but not religious participants. And in his drawing, he had himself praying to Jesus, and there was a cross on the wall in his drawing. And so the researchers were thinking, oh, we probably put him in the wrong group. And as he started to describe his, you know, spirituality, he said, no, I'm not religious. I don't go to church. But his spirituality was all about what his upbringing and his religious life, praying to Jesus, praying to God. And that, you know, culturally was very prominent for him in his spirituality. But in his mind, religion is associated with the physical of going to church. And so that just shows you one example of just like the nuance of what these terms mean, and that they're fluid and they don't, you know, as I've encountered a lot of religious scholars through this work, you know, there's still a kind of insistence that what was the definition of spirituality you gave people? And what was the definition of religion that you gave people? And that how much these kind of, everyone needs to agree on what this term means before engage in the research. Of course, we had other, you know, scholars who were very appreciative of our kind of from the ground up, like just, hey, we're not going to tell them what it means. We want to hear in their terms, what does spirituality, religion mean to you? And ask them more questions about their practices. So what we, you know, ultimately one of the bigger findings was that the majority of Americans are spiritual and religious, and we give a lot of attention to the, you know, in terms of their, how they self-identify. We do give a lot of attention to the spiritual, but not religious. But there continues to be a pretty small percentage of Americans overall.
So that's fascinating. So you said what you discovered through these studies, these investigations, is that the majority of Americans are spiritual and religious.
Yeah. Yeah. So the question, the questions were asked, and it was self-identification, but the questions were asked in two questions. To what extent do identify spiritually? And it was not at all, slightly, moderately, or very. And then the same question, how do you identify religiously? You know, not at all, very, slightly. And so when you look at those that are, you know, not at all religious or spiritual, I think it's in the, you know, single digits percentage. And then those that are spiritual and religious, the, you know, they may be saying they're slightly spiritual or slightly religious, moderately or very. I think it's 86%. I need to pull open the report because we just recently published this. So the Fetzer Institute published this study. It'll be available this month that we're talking in December, I believe. It may be in January, but I can give you these exact figures in a minute.
Well, what I think is so fascinating is I'm endlessly reading news articles that say that the Americans are becoming spiritual, but not religious. Like they self-identify, yeah. They say, hey, I believe in something, but I'm not religious. But it sounds like.
Yeah. So to be clear, those that have been doing, you know, ongoing studies of people's spiritual or religious identity, there is a trend that continues to show that people are less identifying as religious. Our own research shows that trend over the few years that we did it, though it was very, very minor change. You know, to a greater degree, we're seeing the decline in people that, as we heard from Daniel, that are not a member of a congregation, are not going to church. So I think for the first time a couple of years ago, Gallup was the first to announce this, and our research affirmed it, that, you know, it's under 50% of Americans, you know, go to church or a member of a congregation or religious organization. But as we heard from Daniel, this nuance of, you know, we may not be identifying religiously, but we have, you know, religious practices in our life, right? And so that's going to show up more in what our spiritual lives look like. So just looking at the figures again, so 65% of people identify as spiritual religious, 18% identify as spiritual only, 12% identify as neither religious nor spiritual, and only 3% identify as religious only. So when you think about, you know, what spirituality means to us, you know, over 80% of people have some degree of spirituality in their lives. And I think, you know, as I'm a Gen X person, when I was younger, I certainly was kind of aware of the New Age movement or New Age spirituality. And I think for many years there, spirituality was a concept was kind of relegated to, you know, the New Age folks or what they do in California. And I think that now it's really become a more culturally understood and acceptable term, that people have a spiritual life. And you probably encounter this a lot in your conversations, and that shows up in so many different ways.
Thank you for that. And I would so love to hear, was there a big change in results between the 2020 results?
In terms of this identity question?
Well, in COVID, you know, just...
Yes, yes. Yeah. Well, so we did see, you know, on the whole, just very minor and even not singularly as statistically significant declines around like spiritual identity, spiritual practice. But overall, you can kind of start to see a pattern that there's just a little bit less. We'll see, you know, how that continues to bear out. But what we saw, you know, with this research from the pandemic was really an ask pointed questions about how did your spiritual life change as a result of the pandemic. And I will just say we asked a few open-ended questions that were really profound and really touching. And, you know, just I recall an older Native American woman describing losing both of her parents. And just, you know, when she mentions that, when we asked how did your spiritual life change, as she said, these were the most important guiding figures in my life, and I am still grappling with how I move forward. And this will be probably the biggest spiritual question of my life. And so, you know, really interesting to read that profound loss. I remember a 20-year-old describing how she wasn't able to participate in her high school graduation and reflects on how this was the biggest moment of her, you know, transitioning from a child to an adult, and that she really laments that. And she feels like it had a profound impact. I mean, it gets me a little teary just thinking about those kinds of losses that we've, you know, have not fully maybe acknowledged, like certainly, you know, understanding the loss of both of your parents, but something that we may just say, oh, you know, it's just a ceremony. But here she is, you know, coming, you know, into her own life as an adult and just saying, like, I miss this ritual. I missed this ritual. And I think it's really changed me. So those are just some comments on just how people described how their lives changed. But what we saw, you know, in terms of practice is that certainly less church attendance, because that wasn't available to people, though we asked about online participation, of which there was some. You know, on the whole, practices declined, but the ones that increased, like being in nature and art, were interesting. Prayer remains, and other researchers, you know, show that that prayer is the top spiritual and religious activity, whether you're religious or not. That continued. And the practices that really helped people get through were, you know, things that gave them a sense of hope or helped build resilience were some of these common practices. Prayer, art, reading, being in nature were all those kind of in the top list of activities. And I would also say what we found was the impact that these practices had on spiritual growth or resiliency. And we asked some questions about do you feel like you grew spiritually? Did you feel like you had a deeper meaning and purpose in life? And those that had kind of a fuller extent of a spiritual life, meaning they have daily spiritual experiences as simple as, you know, feeling grateful for their blessings or feeling grateful for the beauty of creation, having those daily experiences, engaging in practices, having a sense of a community or belief, you know, both of those, all of those together add up to those in having a more resilient life through the pandemic, feeling that, yes, that they were able to grow spiritually during, you know, what we would say is one of our darker times as a human, right? Like living through that pandemic. But those that had in some ways were in touch with their spiritual lives and engaged in that regularly seemed to do better through the pandemic than those that didn't.
I do think that we're going to be trying to reconcile and kind of heal so much of the grief. I think the pandemic brought so much grief to so many people. I think it's going to take years to reconcile it and understand it and unpack it and comprehend the vast amount of grief that's out there still.
Yes, very much. Well, I think there's an interesting connection between grief, between my own spiritual awareness or moments and you know, kind of moving back into the personal, my own story. I'll just, you know, end with the Fetzer Institute research to say that, you know, I know will be available on the Fetzer Institute website. I'm not a spokesperson for the Fetzer Institute. I just love the work that they've done and was really grateful for the part I was able to play with some of that and happy to share some of those findings, but you can learn more at Fetzer.org. But, you know, let's just this notion that certainly that research pointed to and that that I personally have had an experience with around grief, though it wasn't during the pandemic. I mentioned, you know, I lost my husband several years before the pandemic, untimely, right? Cancer. Colorectal cancer. So I'll just do a plug for everyone to get their colonoscopies because he was diagnosed before the screening age, which used to be 50. And, you know, it's a hard question to think about what would have happened had he had a screening earlier, but he was asymptomatic, and, you know, had fourth stage diagnosis of colorectal cancer, and, you know, had several years of life of trying to, you know, tackle that, and had some good years with some treatment, but ultimately it was just too foregone and hit too far into his liver to come back from. So he died, you know, just shy of his 52nd birthday. You know, we had met when I was 18. We were in love immediately. We had an amazing life together, wonderful children, and just built a, you know, a partnership and kind of grew up together. And he was really everything. He was everything to me. And that kind of grief, I really recognize myself in the woman who talked about her parents, who just said, you know, these were guiding figures in my life, and how I move on without them is, you know, a profound spiritual question. And I very much, you know, live that out and continue to live that out. Facing, you know, the loss of my soulmate and my partner in life and, you know, dad to my kids and all of those things, best friend, just had such a profound impact on how I would live my life. And, you know, I've had moments throughout my life of where I would say I have moments of mystery or moments of wonder or moments of profound spiritual awareness have not come to me in these kind of unexplainable or miraculous moments. They've come to me as a profound, deep awareness of what I said, you know, my dad and my mom and just growing up in Placidus kind of instilled in me is this, you know, we're so grateful to be part. I'm so grateful to be part of this world. And when I feel that, you know, when I feel connected to the world in these everyday moments of kind of awe and wonder, that's where I feel like there's miracles and just spiritual awareness, right? They don't come to me in these like unexplainable moments. They come to me in this, like, it's very explainable moments. You're recognizing the beauty of this interconnected world. That said, you know, when I maybe related to that, but kind of a different experience, my husband died in a hospice center. We had a 5-year-old at the time, and he was really clear that he, you know, didn't want to die at home, but he wanted to die in a comfortable place. And so we found a beautiful hospice center, Rose Arbor Hospice, which was in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And he was there for about a week until he died. And the evening he died, a few things happened that I, you know, can share as these kind of synchronicities, you know, maybe coincidences, maybe miracles, you know, however you want to describe them. For me, they were just, I'm just so grateful that they happened. The first was, you know, the as he was getting closer and the nurses were explaining, you know, what signs we were looking for his, you know, passing. He was very, you know, much less lucid, sleeping, you know, pretty much all the time. And my biggest fear staying overnight with him was that I was going to be asleep when he died. And I was, you know, terrified of that. And I know I would, you know, try to sleep lightly, but, you know, wasn't, I'm a deep sleeper and was worried. But what the evening my husband died, I started to hear a really labored breathing, very, very heavy, heavy breathing. And it woke me up, and I went by him and I laid in the bed with him, and it immediately ceased. Like, it wasn't, as some people who know about the dying process, often there's a death rattle, which is like, it's just it's like almost kind of choking sound that can happen. But it wasn't that. It was him waking me up, and it was him, you know, wanting me to be with him, and that he needed to do that labored breathing so that I could be there. And he wasn't lucid at this moment, right? Like, there was no conversation or awareness, that I could see, but that was, you know, a moment that, was profound for me to be able to be awake and with him and, you know, play the music that I wanted to play, light the candles, talk to him, tell him it was okay. So he passed, and it was excruciatingly hard. And it was also, you know, a beautiful moment. I heard someone recently describe the loss of her child as the single worst thing she experienced. And at the same time was talking about it was the single biggest gift she ever had. And that being able to hold both the sadness and the grief and the just loss at the same time, recognize that you're able to be witness to something like that, right? Is to be witness to life passing and moving on. And I will say, and this could be a much longer conversation if I go into it, but I was also with my dad when he passed, and that was some 25 years ago now. But back to my husband, just to say the second part of this story was, you know, figuring out how to leave the hospice center, right? So they cared so deeply for him. There was a beautiful quilted cloth that they put over him, and just that whole process that you go through when someone departs and they need to actually do something with the body. And I had my time with him, and then it was time for me to leave. And it was very, very early morning, probably between 4 or 5. It was still very much dark out. And we had had a connection to the moon throughout his cancer journey. And there's this great Rumi poem about the water connecting to the moon and longing for the moon. And so he wore a bracelet that had water and moon on it. We had songs around the moon. I mean, the moon had just shown up in our lives in many different ways. And when I left the hospice center, he was a song he used to sing to our kids that had a banana moon hanging in the sky. So when I left the hospice center, I'm on a stretch of a straight highway, and right in my vision, as big and bright as you can imagine, was a crescent moon, just in my view, huge, still, and just present. Right. And that, unexplainable. Yeah. But it connects to my recognition of the awareness that you can have with signs like that so quickly. And just to, you know, my young daughter, after my husband died, would remind me, she comforted me more than I think I comforted her. She was only 5, of just how her dad is always with us. He's right here. He's always with us. He's always with us. And that moment of leaving the hospice center to be so profoundly encountering something that was so meaningful for us, as the sign that he is indeed always with us and part of us.
Thank you for sharing that. Oh my goodness. Thank you so much for sharing that.
It was a moment, and it is, I hesitate. I even heard my inner voice a few times as I was sharing that story. You know, it's a profoundly personal story. It's something that, you know, only I experienced, and I feel that, you know, gratitude of that. I didn't share that story for a number of years, but I did share my grieving quite publicly. I was, you know, with all the ills of Facebook, and there are many, I'm really grateful for the platform it gives for people to, you know, in a very light, easy, not light necessarily, but in an easy manner, be able to share what's going on with you. You know, how are you today? Well, I wasn't well for many years after that, right? And sharing quite, you know, intimate stories of that one is particularly intimate, but other just stories of my grieving and how I was processing it and where I was finding the gratitude and the beauty in moving forward. Yeah, it was a decision I made, and I so respect people that want to keep those stories to themselves and their experiences to themselves when it comes to grief, because it is a very personal experience. But I have found that it has helped me to describe something that other people are going through and have gone through, and that I've heard that feedback of like, you've been able to voice something that I haven't been able to say, but is really important in this journey. So thank you. So, you know, I do like sometimes think, you know, I'm sharing a little too much about how this has impacted me or experiences I've had that are really sacred experiences, like, right. And they're personal and they're mine. But I think, you know, just as we talked about us all growing and having bigger awareness of the and respect for all the new ways spirituality or spiritual life shows up, I think it's good to share. You know, it helps others see themselves perhaps, or have, you know, respect for someone else's personal journey. So yeah, I still, you know, have qualms because it was quite personal and quite profound, but it was, I felt so grateful that I had those experiences because they really helped me continue to move on.
And I don't have children, but I swear the amount of times I've heard people tell me that their child, you know, anywhere from 3 to 4 says the perfect thing at the perfect time. It is astonishing. Children can totally be so potent and profound.
Yeah. And we just, I wonder, you know, where culturally do we tamper that, or, you know, how do our societal norms and being, you know, a grown up, whatever, quote unquote, take away that kind of childhood awareness and recognition of really who we are and what we are. And that is so profound and simple at the same time. Right. And so, yeah, my youngest was just, she had no hesitation. She didn't have any big, you know, questions of what she should be thinking or knowing. She had no, you know, basis for any of that. It was just like what she knew. And what she knew is that her dad is with us and he's always with us. And that gave her comfort. She knew, in comforting me, that was the truth, right? And that sharing that would be important. So she felt it and she shared it. And yeah, kids can be such teachers for us if we just listened a little bit more.
You can envision like that little 5-year-old dropping the mic and walking away and saying, my work here is done.
Yeah. 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 Well, and she was such a spirit, she is still, you know, just a bundle of love. And, you know, at the end of the day, she was 5 too. So, you know, what I was grateful for is that I had a 5-year-old. Not only did she, you know, kind of teach me these bigger spiritual lessons, but she also like needed to be fed every day and needed attention, needed these things. So it kind of took me out of my own wallowing and just, you know, able to take care of her. So there's some practical, things here, but you know, everybody's journey is different. I think, like I said, just having appreciation for that nuance, but recognizing that there are some greater spiritual truths here about, you know, how grief changes us and how we can look to it to help us get through.
All right, that's it. Another week and another episode of the podcast. I want to thank everyone for listening, and I really do need to thank Jillian for agreeing to be a guest, but also for being so open and sharing such a poignant and powerful story. I really do urge each and every one of you, please go check out the results of that study that Jillian was a part of through the Fetzer Institute. I've been thinking a lot about grief recently, and especially how the body holds it. I certainly have my own work to do. Quite honestly, it feels like the work will never be done. But I do think that grief is meant to be shifted and channeled and worked with, almost like you're working with a loaf of bread and kneading it. At some point, if that grief is stuck in your body, it's not good that it's there and it needs to be released. And so whether you do it through crying, or you do it through exercise, or you do it through going into a rage room and breaking a bunch of glass, somatic release, whatever you do, I think especially the years of COVID had such a terrific impact on so many people, and it's gonna take years to unpack how we all survived and now how we can thrive. I need to thank the creators of the music used in this episode, Sasha End. For complete attribution, please see the show notes. Of course, the attributions will be there. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And it would mean so very much to me if you would leave a review or even just a rating. See those stars wherever you listen. They're just calling to be filled out. Those ratings and those reviews, they help me so much. And I'm so very grateful for each and every one. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Jillian. Work with the grief. Share with your community whatever burdens you are carrying, whatever hurts your heart. Share with a friend, share with a family member, share on Facebook, because I guarantee you there are a whole lot of people that would love to just give you a hug or lend you an ear and tell you that everything is survivable with good friends and people who love you.